Hi, welcome to the bonus portion of our discussion with Helena DeBrace of Wellesley. And in this portion, we discuss Exit Zero.
So the book that I wanted to bring in comes from a very different place, but it also has a lot to say both about stories and about what it means to narrate your life and what is the purpose of doing that. And it's a book by an anthropologist named Christine Wally. The book is called Exit Zero, Family and Class in Post-Industrial Chicago. It's a story of her, or it's the telling of her, of Wally's experience as the daughter of a steelworker, who in the 1980s, the factory that her father worked for and that everybody in her neighborhood pretty much worked for, in Southeast Chicago, closed. And her father and pretty much everyone she knew were out of a job. And she had the opportunity to apply to Phillips Academy Exeter, applied and went and became an anthropologist, wrote a bunch of things about, more classical themes in anthropology. She wrote about a nature park in Tanzania, was her first book. But was sort of, persistently wanting to come back to this and sort of tell the story of her leaving, of her own class mobility, but not the mobility of her family and neighborhood and what that felt like. And she does a brilliant job of telling this as a kind of particular story about the U.S., about deindustrialization, and about this tension between, the kind of U.S. narrative of getting out. I'm moving my fingers in a quotation-like fashion here.
there's a joke in Britain, you can always tell the anthropology department from a distance because people are going.
Right, exactly, yes. I had a friend who used to call it the little bunny foo-foo.
Yeah, right. Like,
what's doing? I don't even want to know.
But this story about getting out and that this is kind of seen as the sort of triumphal end of the story when, in fact, what happens and what is that sense of dislocation that comes about in relation to that. But she also, writes really interestingly about what it's like to write an ethnography about herself and her family, both from a kind of ethical perspective and just a problem of writing, and a question about, to what extent is my family typical or not, and what does that even mean? And she has this really, I don't know, John, do you want to talk about the stories?
I was hoping you would, but okay. One of the things that really struck me, which, Helena, I think was why both Elizabeth and I proposed the pivot at this point, is that the story is, I was going to say the poor man's ethnography, but that's not quite right. It's like more like her realization that when her dad answers one of her questions with a story, he's not deferring argumentation or refusing the analytic. That is his analytic category.
Right.
That is his strategy.
That's
not, and it's not, even like now I feel bad. Like there's this whole concept of like folk ethnography or something, but it's like, it just means like different, make meaning of the world in different ways and, citing a story that tells you about, labor practices or whatever is the way of making that meaning.
She reports it, and the way in which she describes it is sort of her, she keeps coming back home. She's gone to Exeter, and then she goes to Pomona, and then she goes to graduate school, and she keeps kind of trying to work through this material and coming back and talking to her dad and sort of saying, what was it like for the mill to close? And wanting this kind of much more formally analytic answer that sounds like you would get in graduate school or something, and she gets a story, and she's sort of repeatedly frustrated by this, but then comes to realize that this is a perfectly legible form of narrativization and of discussion of the situation.
Yeah.
But it's complicated, right? Because on the one hand, she comes to see that stories are legitimate, ways of structuring your experience and empowering in certain ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But also they're constraining. So a lot of what she's saying in the earlier part of the book is that there are these particular kinds of narratives that people use, sort of master narratives to explain their own experience that don't necessarily fit. And so if you're trapped within one of those kinds of stories, you're not able to speak sometimes. She said sometimes she felt that her father was not able to speak as a result of not being able to fit his experience into that sort of more standard story.
Yes.
So it's this idea that stories are both empowering and constraining.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great point, because my thoughts about the book kind of went in two different directions. On the one hand, I thought of amazing books like Richard Hoggart, Consequences of Literacy, mm-hmm. who's sort of the same generation as Raymond Williams, like these mm-hmm. British cultural studies types. But the way that he could tell the stories, and it's much more explicit with him than with Williams, is to typify, like he needed the solidarity right. narrative in order right. to make sense of it. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way it went. And then the other way I went was towards a book that I also think we're going to talk about in a later podcast, is Privilege by Seamus Khan.
Yeah.
And do you know this book, Helena? Yeah, but it's a book about like being a student at and then teaching at a privileged prep school.
Which I think is actually Exeter.
Yeah, that's right. Good point. Yeah. But one of the points that he makes is about availability of easy narratives. So just like a tiny little detail. Like he represented an awkward puzzle because he was essentially an affluent non-white person at the school, so people didn't know how to place him. Mm-hmm. But he noticed that there's one category of like local working class people that everyone knew how to make sense of, which is that there were a few people who worked at Exeter who were essentially like mentally handicapped. Mm-hmm. And those people, everyone had a great relationship with because they kind of, it like naturalized the
right.
difference, so it wasn't awkward. And it's all about, it's awful, right? Because it's all about a narrative where you can tell a story where it makes sense that Billy, who works in the kitchen, and I could be like friends. Now I'm moving my fingers, friends. Because there's a narrative of difference there, like naturalized difference. But there are other kinds of relationships that were just incredibly awkward because nobody knew how to tell that story.
There's this book called Stories We Live by Dan McAdams, a psychologist who's been writing a lot about for years, I guess, about the relationship between stories and people's perception of meaning in their lives.
Yeah.
It's very much sort of in the area that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And one interesting result of that research is that most people's life stories fit into about 7 different plots. I think it's maybe 7.
Oh my God, it sounds like the Enneagram.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, you're a tragic romantic.
And there's a tendency, some people go towards the tragic, some towards the comedy. You know, so there are these sort of very well-structured
Do the 7 have names?
People, I can't remember now. But, you know, you can think of that
chaotic
as worrying,
evil.
Right? It's one source of
yes.
You know, it's one source of doubt about the usefulness or the genuineness or authenticity of life storytelling if we're really just fitting ourselves into these sort of pre-existing culturally created plots.
Mm-hmm.
So, the sort of worry about artificiality, the thing comes up in, you know, in our discussion of Cusk, too, and the worries that Wolf has about whether her stories are being somehow, I don't know, are not truly genuine or being manufactured for her own narrative purposes. And so, I'm not deeply troubled by that. I feel like you could still, the fact that there's a certain amount of cultural determination, you know, to your story, I don't think takes it off the table as something that could generate meaning for you in a genuine way, but it does raise some concerns about particular narratives that are maybe constraining or disempowering in the way in which may be hard to get outside of them.
And I also think there's just a point there about the comfort that we find when we're telling the story that people acknowledge. I'll share a story about somebody that something happened to a friend of mine. So I have an African-American friend who is telling a story about like her childhood in Georgia to another academic. She said, anyway, so yeah, I got her name, because my dad was the academic she was talking to said, a minister? And she's like, no, a Marxist philosopher. And the woman's like, oh, but it was like really uncomfortable. And there was like this awkward, there was seriously like two, I was sitting there at the table just with my head in my hands, and there was like 2 or 3 minutes. And then finally my friend took pity on the other academic and said, oh, you know, but my grandfather was a minister. And then the woman, who was an anthropologist, by the way, was like, sorry. Was like, oh, of course he was. I'm like, of course he was. Like, in what sense is of course he was the correct response? But it, you know, it just, she needed to be grounded again in her story. She's like, give me a story to live by. Like dad who's a minister. I'm just like, oh dear. Yeah. But But I feel like we're all the bad guy in that story at times. You know, like we all find that.
Yeah. Another thing I really loved about the Sex and Sarah book was just how she's struggling against the constraints of writing within her own discipline, right?
Yeah.
So like academic writing, the form of academic writing is not enough for her to express her experience, but she's not sure, what is this thing I'm writing? It's the similar question about what is the form, really, that I need to express what I want to say.
Yeah.
It's not really a memoir. It's not really a, you know, standard academic work. What is this thing?
Yeah.
I think she does it very well. It's a different kind of thing. It seems well-balanced to me, but a lot of the book is sort of struggling with that question.
Yeah. About,
and I guess that holds the three together, actually. That's something that all three, both the Wolf, the Cusk, and Chris Whalley's book, are trying to sort of find their sort of in between these genres that are about the self or about the other, and trying to kind of find their place within it.
Yeah,
and I know we need to wrap up now, but I did actually want to say another thing that I loved about this book, Elizabeth, which is just, it was totally awesome book, was the way in which she is interested, and I think it's because of the difficulty of her own writing project, she's interested in a distinction between narratives of social mobility that are understood as like potentially collectively shared versus narratives of individual social mobility.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, she offers us a genre in which she can really tell the story about her getting out and about and then being able to look back and critically reflect.
Right.
And on the other hand, she reminds us that that's actually like also kind of historically contingent, because nowadays, in the last couple of decades, the narratives of social mobility are about individuals breaking away from their community. You know, like in the middle of the century, we had narratives of like community advancement.
Right.
But we really don't have those anymore. Yeah. And we can look back and say, oh, well, there's this American story about mobility. But that mobility in the current economic reality is really different from what we had in the middle of the century when people, you know, when there was a genuinely growing middle class.
Right. Yeah. And which actually was the story that steelworkers believed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, steelworkers were examples of groups of people and communities that had a path, potentially at least, to mobility, but, you know, it was the path that was shut off for her father and for other people.
Oh my God, so like the version of this that would be, like the pop culture version of this would be from the movie Breaking Away to Exit Zero. Because Breaking Away, he's going off to study in France, but it doesn't mean he's like abandoning
And there's that speech about like stonecutters built the University of Indiana.
Right.
We hope you enjoyed this bonus sliver of Recall This Book. Please let your friends know about the show by posting on Facebook or tweeting or writing a review on iTunes or wherever you normally get your podcast. We'll be back real soon.